Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Tuesday, U.S. General Daniel Bolger, commander of U.S. forces in Baghdad, handed General Aboud Kambar, commander of the Baghdad Operation Command, a key to the old Iraqi defense ministry. It was meant to symbolize that 6 years after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, control of the cities was now in the hands of Iraqis, not American troops. President Nouri al-Maliki called the pullback a great success and declared Tuesday National Sovereignty Day. President Obama said U.S. forces met a June 30th deadline to complete their withdrawal from urban areas and hand over full control to Iraqi forces. But during a press conference for Pentagon reporters, the senior commander in Iraq, General Ray Odierno, lost his temper when he was repeatedly questioned about the number of U.S. troops that would remain in cities as advisors to Iraqi forces. After repeated questions about how many troops were not redeployed, he said, quote, "I don't know exactly how many are in the cities. It varies day to day. Based on the mission." So on today's Your Call, we're going to go past the headlines to talk about what is actually happening on the ground, what has really changed, and what still hangs in the balance. What troops actually withdrew, how many are still left, where are they going, and what's going on in the streets of Iraq. We are joined from Baghdad by Basma al-Khatib. Basma is a women's and children's rights activist and a humanitarian worker, and she's joined us many times over the years on Iraq shows. Hi, Basma. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. How are you? Thank you.
Good. Nice to have you. Thanks for joining us. We are also joined by Nabil Al-Takriti, Assistant Professor of Middle East History at the University of Mary Washington. Nabil has done quite a bit of work with Iraqi refugees in Jordan. Hi, Nabil. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you. We are also joined by Raed Jarar. He is an Iraqi architect by training. His family was forced to flee Iraq after the U.S. invasion. He now does work with the American Friends Service Committee in Washington, D.C. Hi, Raed. Welcome to the show. So, Basma al-Khatib, you are in Baghdad. I want to start off with you. We haven't heard from you in a while. Can you just give us an update? What is daily life like in Baghdad, and what is the infrastructure situation like?
Nothing has changed. In fact, it's got worse because the state, as Iraqi used to, state controls everything, and its state is inefficient because it's controlled with the political quota, corruption, everything. So as far as daily concerns, it's getting worse. And as far as the withdrawal of the troops, it's the same thing. Same as day before and same day after.
Basma, because in the U.S., it's the headlines on Iraq have definitely gone down over the past few years. When you say it's gotten worse, can you describe that to us? I mean, tell us in terms of water, electricity, just basic infrastructure. What is that like?
Well, Iraq has gone through 14 years of sanctions, and before that, the longest conventional war in the 20th century. And all the financial resources went through, for devastation, violence, and everything. So it was already cracked down infrastructure. It was barely holding on. After 2003, political system, political regime, everything was changed. Actually, the devastation of, the bombing and looting and everything. And those people who came in power were not professionals. They were brought by extremist blocs whose main priority is, the political quota of control and chairs. They are not professional people, no technocrats. So Iraqis were hoping when, violence calmed down after the surge, there should be certain parallel measures at policy level, at least for the state level. There wasn't any. So this led to further complete devastation of infrastructure. No public services, nothing. In addition to suppression and of rights, threats of constitution to be dedicated to entrench exclusion of rights of women, ethnicities, and everything.
And I want to give out the phone number because it's very rare to have an open line to someone who's actually in Iraq. And if you'd like to ask Basma Al-Khatib a question or if you have a comment, you can give us a call now at 866-798-8255. And because the lines are bad, we don't know exactly how long we'll have her. But now is a good time to call 866-798-8255. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. So what about the American presence on the streets? What does that look like and how has that changed over the past few months?
Past few months, yeah, you don't see them a lot. You see Iraqi forces, security forces, roaming the streets at the checkpoints, messy clothes and unorganized, have different leaderships, different allegiance. Well, so they were less visible for the American troops. But it is an agreement. I think what happened with you seeing space channels, Iraqis are celebrating. Iraqis want to get out and have something, you know, to celebrate with. So there's the music and somebody is celebrating. They would join in. This is, I think, what happens. But at a daily basis, details, everything, it's not changed.
In this country, Basma, we saw images of people dancing and celebrating in the streets. But who was actually celebrating? And did you see a lot of that in your area?
No, actually, a couple of days before the 30th of June, we were advised to stay at home because nobody knows. The situation is still fragile. What I think happened is that people, after the surge, when things calm down, every district has its own parks and own gathering places, the markets. They're in there, and you put up, you know, some music and some things for celebrations and confettis, then people will just have fun. But it's not about, I think, what happens. None of the people I know were going out because they're celebrating sovereignty or, you know, it's a national day, like they said in the speeches. It's not that way because none of this is happening. Nothing is affecting Iraqis. They have nothing to do with it. This is an agreement to organize relationship between Iraqi government and the troops of U.S.
And we have a question for you, Basma. Let's hear from Vernon in Oakland. Hi, Vernon. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I'd like to know if the militias are playing a role in keeping security in Baghdad and other cities. Now that the Americans are going to go, are the militias, for instance, in Sadr City, are the militias there? Are they playing a role in protecting that neighborhood and so on?
All right. Thank you, Vernon. Basma, are you able to hear the caller? Were you able to hear Vernon?
Nothing.
Okay.
Completely cut off.
So Vernon wanted to know what role are the militias playing in keeping security? What role, for example, are they playing in Sadr City? Basma?
Militias in the streets or in the security forces?
Well, both. Yeah, can you talk about both?
Well, most of the militias follow certain blocks, block leaders, sheikhs, or whatever clerics, they've enrolled officially in the security state forces. So in every area, when you go into a checkpoint, you still worry because these people are militias wearing, or you know, the outrim for them is the state checkpoint, but it's not. You don't trust them, and their allegiance is not for the state or the country. Their allegiance is for their political bloc leader. This is the difference.
And can you talk about the role of the Sons of Iraq, the Awakening Councils? What's the status of
Awakening Councils? The tribal. It's the tribal thing. When the state, this shows you how the state is weak. During the surge, yes, they helped. Also, with the tribe support council, they help with the surge, and I believe certain neighborhoods became quite much better. But at the policy level, you don't see a policy what to do, reintegrate, what to do, have certain policy with these groups, whether Sahwa or the support tribal support councils. It's still chaotic. You have different centers of powers here, so everybody I mean, if you follow this one, then you're contradicting this one. So it's chaos. I think this is what's happening for Iraqis. They understood this and decided to go on with their lives just similar as they used to do before 2003.
Now, Bill El-Tikriti, do you want to jump in here? Do you have a question for Basma?
Well, the question I had before was basically how much were people actually celebrating, and I think she's answered that. It sounds like it's very localized and not nearly the landmark that was presented on some of the media yesterday.
Yes, it was.
And I'm also kind of curious how are the delivery of utilities going, electricity and water and sewerage? Has it improved in, say, the last 6 to 8 months?
No, it hasn't. With corruption, Iraq, I think it's coming either first or third, I think. Only two countries are ahead of us. But we are the worst country with corruption. And corruption with everything, even with the desertification that we see now in Baghdad, was full of sandstorms and dust. This all calls for, lead you to, you know, the upriver, downriver treaty with Turkey and Syria. Nobody's negotiating for the sake of the country or preserving the lands of Mesopotamia, which was basically between two rivers. Now we have desertification era coming in. It's nonstop sandstorm. It's corruption. Those people are not there for the country. There should be change of regime. They're not even a regime. I don't know what they are.
Well, one thing I wonder specifically is how many hours electricity a day do you get at your house from the central government, and how much do you have to rely on the generators?
It's still, now they say it's getting better. It is, compared to zero last summer. You get sometimes 4 hours a day.
4 hours. And if I remember correctly, for Baghdad in 2003, it might have been eight?
Over 50. Yeah, and the fuel, even now, we're oil country, but you buy it from the black market. And it's not as good, even with our refineries now importing all oil products, because they're not functioning. So the overburden of the economical hardship is really, with the unemployment, everything. So people, as I told you, decided to go on with their lives. It's good enough that much, much less violence than before, but we're not back to the level of 2005.
How about the delivery of public distribution rations? Are they able to deliver the rations in whole and to every neighborhood?
Well, I don't get it. I don't. I'm supposed to. I have a card, but I was never able to get it because with the after the violence and the sectarian violence between 2006-2007, many families moved from their neighborhoods, and the food ration depends on an agent that locally is providing you with the supplies. And they cannot take these supplies from another neighborhood. So I think if they do some kind of statistics on this, you find that probably one-third of the population or more taking the food rations and not really getting any benefit from that.
And Basma, hold that thought. We're going to hopefully keep you. Hopefully your line will stay with us. If you have a question or comment about Iraq, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, San Francisco. The time is 20 minutes after 11. Coming up at 12 o'clock, it's Bina, Creative Voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. At 1 o'clock, it's Open Air. This is Alan Farley. I'll be talking with James Gaffigan, conductor of the Symphonies Summer and the Symphony Series, opening tonight. And his soloist for tonight, Gabriela Montero. At 2 o'clock, it's Dispatches from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation right here on KELW. Stay tuned.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our daily newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We'll be joined by Matthew Bajeko of the Bay Area Reporter, David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, and Alan Moss of The Socialist Worker. And I'll actually be on a media panel tomorrow night with David Barsamian and Alan Moss at the Women's Building in San Francisco. You can find information at yourcallradio.org. But today we are talking about the current situation in Iraq. It is being hailed as an independence victory that the U.S. troops are leaving the country, at least parts of the country. And today we wanted to get past those headlines and actually go to Iraq and find out what is actually happening on the ground. We're joined by Basma Al-Khatib. She is a women's and children's rights activist in Iran, also a humanitarian worker. I'm sorry, Iraq, a humanitarian worker. She lives in Baghdad. We're also joined by Nabil Al-Tukriti. He's assistant professor of Middle East History at the University of Mary Washington. He has done extensive work with Iraqi refugees in Jordan. And Raed Jarrar, his family was forced to flee Iraq after the U.S. invasion. He now works with the American Friends Service Committee as their Iraq consultant in Washington, D.C. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Raed, let me bring you into the conversation because you lived in Iraq up until the invasion. Your family was forced to flee, and now you're in D.C. You have extended family still in Iraq, but do you have any questions for Basma about what's really happening on the ground?
I'm very happy to hear that we have someone from Iraq on the phone. That's an excellent development. Instead of just talking about Iraq with D.C. pundits,
yeah.
We actually have someone from Iraq. I just wanted to ask, how is the general mood regarding the upcoming elections in Iraq? Because I'm personally hopeful that the next elections might be a good step for more political participation and maybe a good step for national reconciliation. I'm very curious to see how the mood is on the ground in Iraq.
Basma, were you able to hear that?
No,
okay.
Parliamentary elections?
Yes.
Yeah, the parliamentary elections in January, yes.
Well, after the provincial elections in January 2009, most of the cleric blocs were really alarmed of the of their position and what they're doing on the ground. I do not think that they will maintain the same elections law, because it would not do them any good, you know, open lists and everything, because they will lose their quota. I think they will go further into the PR, the proportional representation, and they will try to make it into, closed diasporic elections. They were really alarmed, and they started shoving accusations against each other. So there will be. I think people will go for to participate in this election vastly, but I do not think, because the figures that we have in Iraq and the complexities of arrangement of these blocs is not competent or efficient. You can control, make change in the state of the elites. They force change. They force cooperation, advice, and everything. Elites are elites. Where are they? What we have now, I think people who couldn't go out, the elites that we have, elites who have been sanctioned, under sanctions in a way from the outside world for 20 years, and who are now giving our students in universities completely old and conventional materials. So, well, even our graduates and experts, those who've returned from exile, are now compromising on their interests. So we doubt that there will be some change.
And we have an email for you, Basma, from Celine in Capitola, and it's about Iraqi deaths. And at least 447 Iraqis were killed in June, double the toll from the previous month. This is according to an AP tally. We've seen several huge bombings over the past 10 days. And Celine wants to know, Basma, are you still with us?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Great. Celine wants to know, how many Iraqis do you think have died as a result of the U.S. invasion? And do Iraqis distinguish between civilians and non-civilians in the numbers?
Well, access to information for Iraqis, most of us depend on mass media and internet. Internet is very popular because much of the time you're staying at home and you have to depend on the social networking. But statistics from any formal or UN or any resource that you can depend on these statistics, I doubt that we have. And this is a problem because mutual access to information, of whether when I was with civil society or you're in the state, you don't have any statistics. But roughly, the figures, when they say 100,000 or the figure rises up to sometimes 150, it may mean civilians. We don't have militants who are getting killed. Militants have they're armed, but civilians are unarmed. They're killed, and sometimes the figures are not right. Sometimes they just expose only half of the truth. So they're not really a resource for, figures for us. But it's devastating. It's devastating. And the hardship that we go through sometimes, make you just put it aside and try to go on and survive what's happening. But it's in the back of your mind and in your neighborhood, your friend, your family. And this is a big threat. You don't trust the community that you live in.
And we actually have a related question from William. He says that yesterday the current Armed Forces commander was on a PBS national news program here. Essentially, he said that although there was a recent spike of attacks, June experienced an improvement. The commander went on to say overall he felt that Baghdad and Iraq is safe and will be safer even more as time goes on. Do you agree with this? Also, what is your assessment of the recent bombings? What precautions, if any, do you and your neighbors take when you venture out to do daily tasks?
We never stop doing daily tasks. We go to office, children go to schools, universities. We can't stop this. But we develop some kind of, isolation on whatever surrounds you of threats. But with, feeling secure that things will go on right, no. Nobody's trusting. There isn't no policy. There's no policy for a military. A government has no policy. When you say regime change, what do you mean? I mean, what's the policy of this regime? It's before you have a policy of one political bloc that controls everything. The state was the major interferes in controlling economy, military, education, health, everything. Now, instead of that one bloc, you have several blocs that are controlling this. When you want to go to a career, you graduate from university, you're unemployed. Hmm. Before, there's one thing, you abide by it. So, no, there is no feeling of secure, economically, human security, everything. It's not, the services. Even to go to private sector, there's nothing to protect you. So I don't think, probably when he says this, as in the military, he means that they are in control. But what's happening on the streets, they don't see beyond their guns and their rifles and their machine guns. They don't see beyond that.
And do you have to still go through checkpoints? Are neighborhoods still separated by walls?
Less walls. I mean, instead of 3-4 meters walls, now there are 150 centimeters walls. Certain, they try to open, but these streets are devastated. We're turning from urban, like I live in the Yuna neighborhood. It's considered one of the elite neighborhoods, an upper middle class neighborhood. Not a single street has escaped the corrupt dealer of sewage or electricity, or trying to fix the pavement. But these are not efficient people. They just give them contractors, unprofessional. So they just, what they do, they just corrupt what we have left. You know, for 20 years, we didn't have any repairs or any new streets or networks of plumbing. But now they just, even that, they destroyed it. So we're turning from urban neighborhoods into country.
Well, thank you for the email, Celine and William. And if you'd like to email us, it's feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also give us a call at 866-798-8255. If you have a question for Basma Al-Khatib, we've been really lucky with her phone line. You can give us a call. She's joining us from Baghdad. And then also, what did you make of the news this week that U.S. forces are pulling out of certain parts of Iraq, and that, you know, we saw images on television and then heard on the radio that people were celebrating? What do you make of this? What changes do you think are really taking place here? And if you have any basic questions about what's happening on the ground, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. We are also joined by Nabil Al-Tukriti. He's Assistant Professor of Middle East History at the University of Mary Washington, and he's done extensive work with refugees in Jordan. We will talk about refugees later in the show. But now I would like to welcome Marwan Swedan to the show. Marwan worked in an anti-corruption office of the Coalition Provisional Authority Swiss Agency for Cooperation and Development on healthcare in the Ramadi Hospital. He came to the U.S. after his father was assassinated. Marwan, welcome to the show. Marwan, are you with us?
Yes, I'm hearing you.
Hi, welcome to the show. And where are you located now, Marwan?
I'm located in San Rafael in Bay Area, California.
In San Rafael. Okay, so can you tell us, first off, how long have you been here? When did you leave Iraq?
I leave Iraq in late of 2006, and I came to the United States in last August.
And so, Marwan, what do you make of the situation on the ground and the announcement that a number of American troops are leaving certain parts of Iraq?
Well, from the news I get from my friend and from my connection back in Iraq, is still bad and even getting worse last couple of months. And regarding the pulling out of the troops of Iraq, I'm actually feeling very sad because they didn't meet their goals and their obligations toward my country and the promises that been held before. None of them was established till now.
And when you talk to your friends in Iraq after this pullout, the 130,000 troops will remain, over 200 bases will remain, and then there's, of course, the largest embassy in the world in Baghdad. What are the solutions? I mean, what are you hearing from friends about, you know, what they want?
Well, it's all about corruption, actually, in government. Most of my friends are doctors in hospitals, and I'm getting, like, feedback about the corruption, expired drugs, non-well supplements, non-well equipment hospitals, lack of medical facilities, the treatment facilities, and the doctors in Iraq are still under threat. I actually lost two doctors last month.
Mm.
One of them was returning from Jordan to Iraq after the Iraqi government asked all the doctors to return back. And when he returned, after 1 week of his return to Iraq, he was assassinated in Yarmouk Hospital, in front of the Yarmouk Hospital, between the police officers who was looking at him.
Now, one of the arguments by people who advocate for a complete withdrawal say that if there's no occupier there, the violence will decrease dramatically. And Muqtada al-Sadr actually sent out a press release yesterday saying that this withdrawal was a mere media announcement. But a number of people like Muqtada al-Sadr basically said, stop the violence, stop killing each other, because the occupying forces are slowly leaving. What do you make of those statements?
Well, look, the people who made the chaos in Iraq, they're still in Iraq. The only thing that changed that the Americans who stopped them before were getting out of Iraq and leaving the field for them. Like al-Sadr militia, one of the parts that make chaos. And al-Qaeda will wait the Americans to pull out to enter again. And there's several militias belong to several political parties just waiting for Americans to pull out to reactivate their activities inside Iraq. And I'm sure of that because of many causes. One of them is corruption, like the fire happened in Ministry of Health last month. it was done by militia to overcome one of the cases in Ministry of Health regarding the private drug, that third drug. So I don't believe of what they are saying or whatever they say. That means nothing.
And do you see any profound shifts at all under the Obama administration in regards to his Iraq policies?
Well, no, not at all. Mm. Actually, President Obama's first goal is to get the troops out of Iraq at that time as he can. And I think this is his priority, and keep the system there, what Americans believe it's a democratic system. We're still in the beginning of democratic system. It's not a full democratic system till now.
And Basma, what about you? I mean, are people, do they have any hope, or is there, have any opinions changed about U.S. policy toward Iraq with Obama in power?
Well, hope is still existed. You know, we didn't get hope till now. But if President Obama administration make a clever move toward Iraq, I think they can do something on the ground. But it's now politics more than army interference. But it depends on the administration whether they're willing to do that or just willing to pull out the troops and that's it.
And Basma, what are your thoughts on that?
Yes. Well, I think Iraqis love Obama. That's in the first place. But also they know that not a single speech nor any policy for a state would do any good for Iraqis unless they do it for themselves. And we have a long way, because democracy do not just, you know, pop in into a culture. Iraq has been isolated. The state controls everything, ideology, economy, military. Till now, the opposition either shut up in Iraq or live abroad, live in exile. So it's the same thing that's happening. And without the people who don't use any arms, elites, they don't use arms, they do the strategic planning, they're professionals. Without them in the country, there is no hope. Our institutions, educational, is there a chance that they can create a generation like what we saw with the third generation of revolution in Iran? No, because unfortunately, under tyranny, you can find a steady educational system, health system, no citizenship, but more patriotic transcendence. So this is what we saw in Iran. Unfortunately, now, whole system, educational, health, everything is devastated. Mm. And without a change of regime, and this might take a while, but we believe in the will of Iraqis to change with the access to information, like I said, with the social network here. This creating diasporas of elites, very few of us still scattered around Iraq. This is, you know, cocoon sometimes ourselves to protect ourselves, but you just start steadily. But with the state, it's very difficult. You don't trust the state. And the state, still, till now, with all its departments, the idea of Iraqis, the whole culture, that state controls everything. Ideology, if you're not doing very well, unless you're employed by the government and by the state, because they give you pension, they take care of you, they're incompetent. Whether you're graduating without having knowledge of anything on information technology, you can sit there on a desk and get paid. So there is this, you know, a lot of work that needs to be done by Iraqis themselves. But they love Obama. Most of them, they prefer him, you know, than the rest.
But do they think things will drastically change for their lives under Obama?
No, not under Obama. They believe in change. They can change by themselves.
Hmm.
Not right. It will not make any difference, but a significant one.
All right. Let's hear from another caller. Let's go to John in Felton. Hi, John. Thanks for holding.
Yes. Good morning. My question involves. I've always been very interested in what happened after the war.
There we go. I'm sorry. Can you repeat that, John? Your line was bad a minute ago.
Oh, I'm sorry. I've been very interested in what happened after the declaration of mission accomplished when the IMF and World Bank came in and privatized so much of the government services in Iraq. And I'm wondering if there's a reversal in that process and how much it's hurt the country.
All right. I'm sorry, John. We're going to have to let you go because your line is bad, but I think I got the gist of your question. Basma, John wants to know if government services were privatized under Bush. He says that he heard 200 government services were privatized under Bush. Is that true? And what's the status of that?
Yes, corrupt contractors, inefficient contractors. They've been devastating the streets and the network, the plumbing and everything. This is what's happening. These are not professional businessmen. Our professional businessmen and firms are gone out of the country. They gave it to their relatives, to the people, so that they can get, you know, the highest commission of all this. If you read about corruption, it's there, every report on the network.
So as far as we know,
this is the worst thing that happened.
The contractors will remain in Iraq. Do you have any interaction with these contractors? Are they part of daily life in Baghdad?
No, I'm talking about local contractors. The international regional contractors do not go into the streets. They cannot because of the bad security. So what do? They gave the contract and give it subcontract a right. They subcontract then the subcontractor subcontract another one. And can you imagine the size of commissions until it reaches to the services that require to be delivered to the citizen or to any kind of work?
And Nabil Takriti, would you like to jump in on this one? Because I know that you follow contractors. Do you have anything to add on that?
Well, I do think it's not only a legacy of the 2003 invasion and CPA policy, which Naomi Klein addressed in some length in her book Shock Doctrine. It's also somehow a legacy of the 13 years of sanctions that preceded the invasion. So you had the combination of a state sector that was fair enough in human resources in 2003. It was able to keep things going with duct tape fairly well, I would say. But that was abolished, and then there was the violence in 2004 and 2005 specifically targeting professionals. Nobody to this day really knows who did that. And then you combine the two together, actually the three, the privatization policy, the sanctions legacy, and the targeting of professionals, and you have the mess that you have today. What I like about what Basma is saying is that Iraqis see that they're going to have to pull themselves out of this, because I think that's accurate. There's really very little that even a benevolent U.S. government could do to help them, because throwing money at it isn't going to be all that effective, I think.
All right. Well, thank you for the call.
Good.
Thank you for the call, John. We have just over 10 minutes left. If you'd like to join us, the number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. We're joined by Basma Al-Khatib. She's joining us from Baghdad. Nabil Al-Takriti has worked with refugees in Jordan. And we're also joined by Marwan Swedan. He's an orthopedic surgeon who worked in an anti-corruption office of the CPA in the Ramadi Hospital. He came to the U.S. in 2006 after his father was assassinated, and he's now living in San Rafael. So if you have a question or comment for our guests, now is a good time to give us a call, 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Basma, in everyday life, I mean, Iraqis go into the green zone? Can you give us a status on, you know, the bases situation, the green zone, and also the U.S. embassy?
Yes. It's now, I think, for a while, have been controlled also the security, the outskirts of the outcircles also for security for the IZ, they call it, not the green zone, now international zone. They're Iraqis over there. But inside, you immediately can tell the difference. There are international contractors, security groups, and then American, U.S. Army, obviously. There. It's easier than before, I think. It's still circles of security, like they call them belts of security. But it is. But it's taking about one-third of that area. It's covering
still it's on there, it's in there, in lots of neighborhoods, and people who live in there, people, families, of which I know, most of them have left because of sort of these measures. It's part of Baghdad, one of the most beautiful parts of Baghdad. But I think, when during negotiations, sometimes in my work with the international or UN officer that we see, there is an intention to create the IV, not just one IV.
You know, on that note, one thing that occurs to me on that note is that there was a landmark something like 3 or 4 months ago that I think mattered for Baghdad far more than what happened yesterday with the announcement of the withdrawal from cities, and that is that they simply opened up a key bridge that went into the international zone, and traffic immediately improved dramatically throughout Baghdad because it had choked off something like half the city. And that's probably far more important to the Baghdadis than anything that happened yesterday. But it didn't attract any attention whatsoever internationally.
And I think, unfortunately, we just lost Basma. Her line was going out. We'll check on that. But if we did, I want to thank Basma Al-Khatib for joining us. She's joined us several times over the years. We think when we do shows about Iraq, it's really important to actually connect with an Iraqi. She's been joining us from Baghdad. We actually got really lucky to have her on for so long. I also wanted to ask you, Nabil, about the oil contracts. Yesterday, 8 of the 10 most powerful oil corporations in the world were in Baghdad to bid on oil deals. It was broadcast live throughout the country. But they ended up only signing one deal because the oil company said that the Iraqis wanted too much money. This is the first time in 3 decades that they are, you know, going to the table for oil contracts. Can you talk about the significance of this?
Well, it struck me as though they're playing a game of chicken between the central government of Iraq and the oil companies, and it still remains to be seen who's going to win this game. If I understood it correctly, British Petroleum and the Chinese National Oil Company agreed to do business in one field, but the other 8 basically refused, including Exxon, who effectively stormed out of the room, is the impression I get.
Right.
And the largest field, the one that everybody wants the most, Rumaila in the south, was left untapped, at least in this agreement. And the analysis that I saw was suggesting that the oil minister, Shahristani, is under a lot of pressure to get these contracts going, but he's trying to do it in such a way that is not very advantageous to the oil companies, and it's a constant tug of war, and who's winning at this point is a little bit hard to say because 2 companies did agree to do business. The history of that is fascinating, too, because effectively, no matter who's in power in Baghdad, throughout modern Iraqi history, they always are going to have this tug of war, and they always have. And the history of the 20th century has had, until 2003, always been one of increasing central government control over the production and export of oil. I mean, there's landmarks in the 20s, 30s, all the way up through 1974 when they nationalized the entire sector. And that all got reversed in 2003, when basically there was an attempt to go back in time to the old Iraqi Petroleum Company, which was a consortium of Western oil companies, dominating the show entirely as they did back in the 20s and the 30s. And what seems to be happening now is a struggle between those 2 trends, the oil consortiums versus the central government.
Marwan, what do you make of this at a time when the U.S. says that it's withdrawing from Iraq? For the first time in 30 years, Western companies are being given the opportunity to bid on at an auction marketing the first opening of Iraq's oil sector.
Well, first of all, as Iraqi, I feel absolutely sad because back in 1973, when we nationalized all the oil companies, Iraqi took care of his oil field on oil well, and it actually took it very well. We have expertise, the best, I think, in the world, I can say. But now it's like we're going back to point in the history, which is very bad, regarding the Iraqis, because we think that the oil companies will steal most of the money, you know, and give us just a small part, which will be taken by the corrupted government. So
the people will not get any benefits of that. I'm sure of that. I believe in that, actually. But Ministry of Oil says the only way to develop our field is to get, you know, foreign companies to get control of everything. And I think at this point, it means he failed. I respect Shahristani. He have a very high degree, but not in oil development and oil sector. He has a degree in something else. And I think the government should give the oil ministry something to someone able to manage it very well and develop it very well, because Iraqi have the abilities, I believe, to develop it. And we have the money. We can develop it. Why not, you know?
And in our remaining minutes, Marwan, I wanted to ask you, Thomas Ricks, a military reporter for The Washington Post, was on NPR this morning saying that the occupation of Iraq isn't even halfway over. He says that Obama has broken more campaign promises on Iraq than in any other area. And he fears that people have kind of moved on. And now that the force increase in Afghanistan is taking place, he fears that the attention to Iraq will be, you know, even worse than it was 6 months ago. How do you feel about that? I mean, you're in San Rafael. Do people ask you, you know, what was it like in Iraq for you? Are you talking to people in Iraq?
Well, I don't blame President Obama if you want to get the attention in Afghanistan, because the United States has priorities, and I understand that. The national security is what's important here, more than the national security in Iraq or everything else. Regarding, I'm still connecting, yes, friends in Iraq, and they hoping that President Obama will do something serious and something brave, like the changing previous regime. He will change this regime, but I think it's very optimistic at this point to say something like that. But let me tell you something. Why should I believe that any American administration will do something for Iraqi when they failed in the meeting that promises to Iraqi came to the United States at the place? They promised the Iraqi refugee for help and for everything when they came to the United States. But inside the United States, you can ask any Iraqi refugee if anybody in the government do anything for him. So if they failed, the American administration failed to meet the promises here, I don't believe they will do anything for Iraqis.
And Nabil, what would you add to that? You say it's kind of ironic that at a time when the forces are pulling down from Iraq, they're increasing in Afghanistan. And, we, you know, we notice that when we do Iraq shows, we get very few calls. And we often wonder if it's because people just don't know what to say anymore after 6 years of this.
Yes, I think there's Iraq fatigue. It's there. And as long as the events seem under control, and as long as it's Iraqis who are dying in these car bomb attacks and not American soldiers, then that's likely to continue. So that only those who really follow it closely will notice things like collapse of oil deals or withdrawal of troops from certain bases or opening of bridges. These things don't attract any attention in the U.S. anymore. And it's expected, but it's unfortunate a bit for Iraq, because I could see a scenario where things go really badly for Iraq and the U.S. public and the U.S. government doesn't really think it's involved anymore, even though at some level it still is, as long as there's tens of thousands of troops there. But one of the other things about pulling out of the cities is that the troops kind of isolate themselves from the violence in the cities. And as they do so, they can basically wash their hands of the whole thing and watch it from afar. And that's a really dangerous trend at some level, because Iraq could go even further down the tubes in the next year or two, and we won't even notice.
And do you agree with Thomas Ricks? He's a former Washington Post reporter, now writes for Foreign Policy magazine, that the occupation isn't even halfway over?
Well, ask me in six more years.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a hard call to make. But there is the probability that he's right, if only because it's sort of the trend of these things. The U.S., like many other powers in the past, does not easily leave. Not only because they may think there's advantages to staying, but because you sort of naturally have to adopt almost like the inertia of responsibility, and things become permanent whether or not the institutions really want them to be permanent, the sort of the accidental empire idea, combined with the fact that they really do want to control the area. the powers that be in Washington. So I think he's probably right, but we don't know yet. And the Obama candidacy, the Obama campaign, very explicitly said, and they haven't gone back on this yet, that they want full withdrawal by, I believe, August of 2011.
Right.
And we haven't gotten there yet. So if things go well, in an optimistic scenario, they might still reach that goal.
And now, Beal, you also say that you want to emphasize that the country has been just so drastically changed since the invasion. And we didn't even get to talk about refugees. 5 million people have either been internally displaced or are forced to flee. There's no concerted effort to bring those people back. Is that right?
Well, the government, the Iraqi government, has announced some initiatives to try and help bring them back in the last 12 to 13 months. The only thing is they haven't really kicked in yet, and they're ineffective because the security situation is not yet trusted enough for people to go back in any bulk. So the highest number of returnees that I've heard is something like a couple of 100,000 out of that total 5 million. So it's very disappointing. But the other thing to mention is that at some level, the American legacy in Iraq is permanent, or at least it's permanent for the next decade or two. And that is that Iraq has become a more sectarian society than it ever used to be. Mm. And it's a geographically sectarian society more than it ever used to be. It actually is somehow a tripartite country of Sunni, Shia, and Kurd in a way that it wasn't in 2003.
And we're almost out of time, but Marwan, just quickly, do you ever hope or do you hope to go back to Iraq? Can you go back to Iraq?
No, not in the next 20 years.
Why not? We have 10 seconds.
It's very dangerous for me and for family, my family, and I will not go there anymore. I just lose many things. I don't want to go there anymore.
All right. Well, Marwan, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and we will definitely have you back. Marwan Swedan is an Iraqi and orthopedic surgeon who came to the U.S. after his father was assassinated. We've also been joined by Nabil Altakriti. He's done extensive work with refugees in Jordan. Thank you for joining us.
Okay. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I'll be right back to let you know what's coming up tomorrow. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, the day we look beyond the headlines with a panel of journalists from across the media landscape. We'll discuss the Stonewall anniversary, the coup in Honduras, Iraq, and the status of the Free Gaza boat. We'll be joined by Matthew Bajeko of the Bay Area Reporter, David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, and Ellen Moss of the Socialist Worker. Send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org or join us live at 11 a.m. Where did you see the best reporting this week? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW and the friends of KALW. To listen to past shows, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find links there to the Your Call blog and podcast. Malihe Razazan is producer, Ben Temption is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, and Kate Elston is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.